This is Mark, the podcast producer. Just a quick note before the show. Because of the amount of detail in the story of Tirpitz, from construction to destruction, we've split this episode into two parts. This first part looks at the early history of the ship that Churchill called the Beast. Now over to the show.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the November 2024 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Hunting the Beast, Part 1. On the 12th of November 1944, Germany's largest battleship, Tirpitz, was sunk by British RAF Lancaster bombers off Tromsø in Norway. Ever since its deployment to the region back in January 1942, the battleship had posed a threat to Arctic convoy operations. A large part of the Royal Navy's home fleet, as well as US vessels, were tied up protecting convoys from this ship that Winston Churchill christened the Beast. Despite Tirpitz having never fired its guns in anger at Allied warships, its presence was threat enough. Intelligence experts continued the difficult work of tracking its location and state of readiness. The analysts of Bletchley Park's naval section followed the ship for nearly 3 years and played a part in her final destruction. In this It Happened Here episode, we're joined by Dr. David Kenyon, Bletchley Park's research historian and author of Arctic Convoys, Bletchley Park and the War for the Seas. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, we have a special anniversary on the day we're recording this episode. What is that?
Well, regular listeners will remember that nearly 12 months ago, at the end of 2023, we recorded an episode about the sinking of the Scharnhorst, a German battleship, on Boxing Day 1943. And today, 12th of November, is the 80th anniversary from 1944 of the sinking of another German battleship, the Tirpitz, an even bigger battleship.
In fact, we've covered all three of the big ones, haven't we? This will be our third one because we've done the Bismarck, we have Scharnhorst, and we're doing Tirpitz today.
Bismarck is sunk in 1941, so I can't remember when we first did an episode on that. It feels like quite a long time ago.
You say Tirpitz was a battleship, but and all these are battleships, but they're all different.
Well, it's not just any battleship. Tirpitz is part of a plan that the Germans came up with in the 1930s to rapidly expand their navy. Because at the end of the First World War, the German First World War Navy destroyed itself, famously. All the ships were captured and they scuttled themselves in Scapa Flow while they were captured. And so in the interwar period, the German Navy more or less didn't exist. They had a few token ships. But in the late 1930s, they repudiate all the treaties that were constraining their armed forces. And they start building ships. But in particular, they have a program to build battleships. And the regulations, the treaties with the US and with the UK and everybody else, set a maximum limit for how big a battleship could be. And the idea was that if all the countries agreed to the limit, then no one would bankrupt themselves trying to build an even bigger one than anybody else. It's like with nuclear weapons nowadays. It's like an arms control thing. But what the Germans did was they fudged the figures. So Bismarck and Tirpitz are actually bigger than what was allowed under the treaties. Not by a huge amount, but they are bigger than any of the ships built by the British or the Americans during that period. And they are the biggest battleships that serve in the war in the West, if you like.
Yeah.
There are bigger ships in the Pacific because Yamato, the Japanese battleship, is famously one of the biggest battleships ever built. And some of the American ships, the Missouri, for example, is very large. But in terms of the war against Germany, Tirpitz and Bismarck are the two largest battleships in that conflict. Tirpitz herself is over 250 metres long, so you imagine more than two football pitches, She carries 8 15-inch guns, which are more or less the biggest naval guns used in the period, certainly on the British and German sides. So even the newest battleships that the British Navy's got, which is the King George V class, King George V herself or Duke of York, Tirpitz would probably beat them in a one-to-one fight. So it's an incredibly formidable piece of kit. It doesn't make it into service until 1941. It spends a lot of time in first construction and then sea trials, but it becomes fully operational in February 1941. In fact, shortly after Tirpitz is commissioned, the Bismarck makes its first and last foray into war. It goes off round the top of Scotland and into the Atlantic and is caught by the Royal Navy, including by King George V, in fact, and is sunk in May 1941. So almost as soon as Tirpitz comes into service, her sister ship is sunk. But the British have been a little bit preoccupied by Tirpitz already for several years. I mean, they knew she was being constructed, and air raids are launched on the shipyard while she's still being built. And so it's not as if in February 1941 they suddenly go, blimey, the Germans have got this amazing battleship. They've been trying to destroy it before it even touched water.
Right.
But they've not succeeded.
No.
The Germans have managed to build it despite all that. And as soon as it exists, as soon as it's in commission, John Winton, the naval historian, has described the situation quite well. Edmund Hillary famously, when asked why he climbed Mount Everest, said, because it was there.
Yep.
And Winton makes a similar analogy with Tirpitz. He said, all Tirpitz had to do was, like Mount Everest, to be there. In a sense, it's a threat in being. Yeah. It's just, you can't ignore it. Wherever it is in the world, it's going to be a significant threat there. And pretty much straight away, the place the Germans decide to send it is the Arctic, is Norway.
Und obersten Befehlshabers der Wehrmacht taufe ich dich auf den Namen Tirpitz.
Now, you'd probably be the best person to ask this question, seeing you have written a book about the Arctic convoys.
I might have.
Yes. And I know we've covered some of this previously about Arctic convoys, but explain to us the influence that one single ship was going to have on these dozens and dozens of Arctic convoys that were sailing all the time.
Well, the thing is, the public perception is that convoys are all about U-boats, that you have merchant ships and their escorts and they're attacked by submarines. We've covered this before, of course, but in Norway, it's quite different. In the Arctic, it's quite different because you have land-based air power from Norway, but you also have the German surface navy. And Hitler realizes this, and he sends more or less all of his large warships eventually to Norway. And to be fair, most of them end up getting sunk somewhere in Arctic waters, because this is where the naval war is most significant for the Germans. The problem you have is if you have a convoy that is only being attacked by submarines or aircraft or whatever, you can escort that convoy with quite small ships, with corvettes, destroyers, armed trawlers. These kind of ships are perfectly capable of taking on U-boats. But the moment you have a battleship lurking somewhere in the area, were that battleship to get stuck into a convoy, the escorts wouldn't be able to do anything about it. So what it means is you have to up your game in terms of the escort of the convoys. And they didn't actually do this by close escort. You wouldn't have the Royal Navy's big ships sailing next to the merchant ships. What they do is they create what they call a covering force, which stands off a little bit further away from the convoy, but is there in case a German battleship intervenes. And what that means is the home fleet, who are based in Scapa Flow in Orkney, they would like to be doing other things, but their major preoccupation is that every time a convoy sails, they have to put to sea with enough strength so that if a German battleship comes out of a fjord and tries to attack the convoy, they've got enough power to defeat it. And that means at least one of the largest battleships, King George V or Duke of York. For a while, they have an American battleship as well. At least one fleet aircraft carrier, Illustrious, Victorious. And of course, those ships can't sail on their own. They also need destroyer and cruiser escort. So you end up with a substantial chunk of the Royal Navy being tied up for the what if one of Tirpitz or Scharnhorst or any of these other major ships.
Just in case.
Just in case. And simply by sitting there, 1941, 1942, the up to half a dozen decent-sized warships that the Germans have create this threat in being that means the Royal Navy has to undertake much larger scale and more complicated convoy protection exercises than they would have to do otherwise. I mean, the interesting point is that when you tot up all the figures at the end of the war, the German surface navy wasn't particularly effective against convoys. They don't inflict significant damage. They only sink 3 merchant ships in the whole war. That sounds pretty feeble, but some of it is more luck than anything else. I mean, the Tirpitz's first excursion, Operation Sportpalast, in March 1942, could have been a disaster. The Tirpitz very nearly found a convoy, but it was dark and she didn't. It could have gone very differently. Tirpitz also plays a role in the PQ-17 operation, and it's partly the fear of Tirpitz that causes the disaster. Although the merchant ships are sunk by aircraft and submarines, the battle plays out the way it does because Tirpitz exists. And on that occasion, Tirpitz sails out of the fjord and literally goes round the top of the North Cape a very short distance and then turns around and goes back to harbour again. But the fact that it hasn't fired its guns at British merchant ships isn't really the point. The point is all of the strategic calculations that the Royal Navy's had to make, the decision-making they've had to do, knowing that she might come out and attack people. As a result, Tirpitz casts this kind of shadow over the whole campaign from 1941 to more or less the end of 1944, and huge amounts of Royal Navy resource are tied up. And what's noticeable about Operation Torch in 1942 and then Overlord D-Day in 1944 is they have to suspend Arctic operations during those amphibious landings because they need so many ships. For example, for D-Day, the home fleet has to go down to the channel and assist with D-Day. So they don't have enough ships to do that and send Arctic convoys. So the Arctic convoys have to be suspended because Tirpitz is sitting there and they can't risk sending a convoy if the home fleet is busy somewhere else. So very significant influence on the campaign. But it also has this second layer that the propaganda, the public relations war is equally important. The longer it goes on that they can't sink Tirpitz. They've sunk Bismarck, but the longer it goes on they can't sink Tirpitz, the worse it looks for the Royal Navy. And equally, the Germans can make propaganda out of the fact that their ship is still sitting there, you know, and presenting a threat. Churchill, never one to miss a moment of drama if he could avoid it, christens Tirpitz the Beast.
Right.
And he talks of her as the Beast, of this sort of this creature lurking in the fjords that's going to come out and wreak all this havoc. So some of the propaganda threat is boosted by the Prime Minister. Whether that's necessarily constructive, I don't know. But I mean, a lot of it he does in his memoirs, to be fair, after the event. And we'll get into the attacks on Tirpitz in a minute. But once those attacks start and they don't succeed, it becomes ever more imperative for the job to be finished once they've started it. And so sinking Tirpitz becomes a propaganda goal as well as a practical goal.
New kinds of warfare mean new kinds of weapons and armaments. In this latest and greatest of all wars, the aircraft carrier is an indispensable unit of the modern fleet. It has eyes that range across hundreds of miles of sea, bombers and torpedo bombers to act as long-range artillery before the ships attack, fighters to beat off enemy aircraft from her seabound systems. In this war, it's true to say that a navy without aircraft carriers is as unthinkable as an air force without airplanes. Latest additions to the British Navy, our aircraft carriers demonstrate every day their vital importance to the progress of the war. During the most critical period, the Pygmy aircraft carrier was one of the Royal Navy's most powerful secret weapons. These former merchantmen, equipped with flight decks, sailing in convoy, their planes keeping constant watch, the little carriers were a constant threat to the lurking U-boat. Navy flyers take plenty of chances each time they make a landing on decks only 380 feet long. The men of the carriers have played a great and heroic part.
I imagine, therefore, if we were to go back 80 years ago and go down one floor from where we're sitting right now, Tirpitz would be on the minds of the codebreakers at GC&CS.
Very much so. And Tirpitz would probably be a pin on the wall down in the plotting room as well. 80 years ago today, that location would have changed slightly, as we'll come on to. But for a lot of the time, there would have been a pin in the wall in Altafjord showing her lurking as each cotton thread showing the convoy went past on the map.
So in those 3 years that Tirpitz is, as you say, lurking, what part did GC&CS play?
Well, the role of GC&CS at that point is, well, to know, firstly, where is the ship? Secondly, and this will play a part later on, what state is it in? How seaworthy is it? How ready to sail is it? Because having it there is one thing, but as we'll hear later on, it does get damaged but not sunk on several different occasions. And so analysing how long it's going to take to fix it, or whether it's going to be ready to become a threat again, is really, really crucial. And the third one is what the Germans are planning to do with it. So are they planning operations? Are they thinking up an attack on a convoy or a sortie into the Atlantic? Because there's two things. Tirpitz could just come out and attack an Arctic convoy, or it could do what Bismarck did, sail through the Denmark Strait and go out into the Atlantic and start hunting Atlantic convoys, which would be a real disaster because it's a much bigger ocean and it'd be a much harder ship to find, and it could cause real havoc out there. So knowing where it is and what's planned for it is really, really crucial. And this is an area where you see Naval Section and Bletchley Park doing what it does best in many ways, because it's not just about signals intelligence. I mean, they are gathering a huge amount of German radio communication about what's going on, but also they have Norwegian resistance coast watchers. They have these very brave people who are dumped on islands at the mouth of fjords, and they sit there basically in a hole in the ground with a wireless set. They're reporting every time a ship puts to sea or comes back. Incredibly brave people. And just it must have just been miserable as well. I mean, they're living up in the Arctic, basically, in a hole. The weather isn't always good, but they're flying long-range reconnaissance sorties, taking photographs. All of these different sources of information are being gathered together to try and make sure they know what the ship is doing and whether it's going to go to sea and everything else. The other advantage we've talked about previously was they're gaining intelligence from the Swedes, because German Navy is communicating over landline to Norway on cables that travel through Sweden. Although the Swedes are nominally neutral, there's a famous Swedish codebreaker who broke the T-52, the German teleprinter code system. And intelligence is being shared with the British naval attaché in Stockholm as well. They're getting all these snippets of information from different places. Part of the problem with a warship like Tirpitz is it won't necessarily send very many radio messages. Especially when it's in harbour, it'll be against the dock and they basically plug in a telephone cable so that the captain of the ship or the admiral, whoever, can talk securely.
So we forget our usual listening out for Enigma messages, breaking the keys for that day's Enigma setting.
There is that, but it's the opposite. And this is where traffic analysis and Bletchley Park's expertise really comes in, because no news is good news. If you don't hear communications with Tirpitz, it kind of suggests that nothing very much is going on. She's not left port, because like I was saying with the British fleet, you can't just send a battleship to sea by itself, just sort of willy-nilly. There's a lot of preparations that have to go on. Because the British are laying mines along the Norwegian coast, you have to do mine clearance of the route the ship's going to take. They would try and arrange air power to give some air cover for the ship. They would arrange smaller ships to provide escorts. They would need fuel tankers. So there's all sorts of ancillary activity which generates radio traffic, which you can listen into. And being able to infer from that kind of information that there's kind of buzzing coming from the nest that something's going to happen.
So you don't need a message from the captain of the Tirpitz saying, I'm about to leave port or I've left port. All this other stuff will tell you that.
Yeah, even a message asking coastal forces to escort a tanker full of fuel oil up to Altafjord. Why do they need a tanker full of fuel oil if they're not going to do anything with it? Because the Germans suffer from a really massive shortage of fuel throughout the war. It's never lying around spare. If they want to do anything, the first thing they've got to do is sort of go through channels and get a tanker to bring the fuel and everything. Those sorts of activities can tip off the intelligence people. And the other problem you have is, and this runs across all aspects of intelligence, there's people use the term continuity, that if you're watching something or following something, if you lose it or you stop paying attention to it, it's much harder to re-find it again. And so you have to maintain what they call continuity. You have to keep your understanding up to date all the time.
Right.
So even though nothing's happening, there's still people whose job is it to just keep monitoring and monitoring and monitoring. And John Winton, who we spoke about earlier, the historian, has described this quite well. He said, Tirpitz almost took up more staff time and thought, more space in OIC special intelligence summaries, and more text in Ultra signals than any other single ship. In the end, Ultra was to play a major part in her life and death. I've not done it with Enigma messages, but I'm sure if you went through and you identified all of the ones that not they weren't necessarily named Tirpitz, but they provide intelligence that relates to what she's up to.
Yeah.
It would be a huge proportion of the material. I came across an assessment that said that the coast watchers, these Norwegians, provided 145 individual messages just about Tirpitz, let alone any other ships.
Wow.
If you think 145 messages over 3 years, that's at least one a week. So it's absolutely fundamental to their operations. One criticism of this has been made by Ludovic Kennedy, a journalist and historian, who was actually a naval officer during the war, and he suggested that it was harder to know what Tirpitz was going to do than where she was or what she'd done, and that it was kind of a historical thing in a way. He said, despite Ultra, they had rarely known for certain where Tirpitz was or would be. They could only tell, because of the time lag between interception and decryption, where she had recently been. I disagree with that. I think the intelligence is better than that, and particularly with March 42 operation, Operation Sportpalast, and later with Rösselsprung, which was the attack on PQ-17, even though that didn't go very well, they do gain prior information that Tirpitz is going to sail. There is a build-up. In one case, they get information from Sweden, but they're able to pick up on these sort of preparatory signals, just things like people's leave being suspended and things like that. So they are able to predict into the future as well. It's not just, where was she yesterday? Mm. Where's she going to be next week is a viable question to ask of the intelligence, and it is one they can quite often answer.
I mean, arguably, you could say with PQ-17, it was the perfect mission for Tirpitz, because the threat of it attacking the convoy caused the convoy to scatter. The convoy was ultimately picked off, mainly by the Luftwaffe and U-boats, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Tirpitz wasn't sunk by the British.
It's a well-planned operation by the Germans, and there's really not a lot the Royal Navy can do about it. And Admiral Pound gets a terrible bad rap for ordering the scattering of the convoy, because on the night in question, Tirpitz had not put to sea, so he can be criticised on that. But she did put to sea the following day, and had the convoy still been in one piece and sailing along, there's a pretty good chance Tirpitz would have found it. And the Germans have deliberately designed the operation to give the Royal Navy a conundrum they can't unpick, if you like, because there's so many different factors in play, they all counteract each other. It's fortunate for the Allies that they didn't manage to pull that off more often. And it does mean it gives the Germans that tactical flexibility. It gives them the opportunity to present those problems to the Navy. If you've just got submarines, or you've just got aircraft, or you've just got a battleship, any one of those can be counteracted relatively straightforwardly, but it's when you put the whole mix together, the scissors, paper, stone effect, that it makes it much more difficult. They need contrary solutions.
Deutsche U-Boote kehren von siegreicher Feindfahrt zurück. Wieder haben sie viele 10.000 Tonnen feindlichen Schiffsraumes vernichtet. Konteradmiral Dönitz zeichnet besonders verdiente Besatzungsmitglieder mit dem Eisernen Kreuz aus.
Lurking in the fjords of Norway, the beast is laying in wait. What do the Allies do to try and sink it? And how does GCNCS contribute to that?
Well, the first choice, if you like, is to lure it to sea and sink it in a naval battle. And that's what these covering forces are there for. And certainly from 1943, the Royal Navy is strong enough and they've got their operations well enough organised that they're not fearful of Tirpitz coming out of the fjord to attack a convoy. In some ways, that's what they want to happen. They plan the operation so they send a convoy and they go, with a bit of luck, Tirpitz will try to attack that convoy. And we've got a naval force here, you know, battleship, an aircraft carrier, whatever, that can then go and sink it. But the Germans don't take the bait. Tirpitz never comes out. So that you're then presented with the question, if she won't fight you in the open, how do you destroy the beast in its lair? How do you attack it in the fjord? And that presents all sorts of problems, because the anchorages that the German Navy are using, Altenfjord Fjord in particular, which is up near the North Cape, is very difficult to get into. It's a fjord. It's a long, narrow channel. You couldn't send a battleship in there because there's not enough sea room. The German land defences are very good. And from an air attack point of view, these anchorages are easy to protect from air attack, because in many cases you've got vertical cliffs, so you can sort of tuck your ship under the cliff and it gets very hard to get an airplane near it anyway. And then you can put anti-aircraft guns on top of the cliffs, and they have quite sophisticated camouflage systems to hide the ships in the first place, but also they use smoke generators. And what this means is if you hear bombers coming, you just fill the fjord with smoke,
right,
and it sort of settles over the water and you can't see where the ship is. Attacking them there is very difficult. The other problem you have is that Altenfjord, at least, is beyond the range of Allied bombers, even from the north of Scotland. you can't get all the way to the North Cape and back again with a decent bomb load with the aircraft that are available. You have to use aircraft carriers. Or the other option that the RAF apply is if you fly to Russia, you can get to the North Cape, and then Russia and the Allied bases in Murmansk are only a little bit further around the corner, if you like. The North Cape is most of the way to Russia. So you can either send aircraft to Russia and have them do a bombing mission on the way back, or you can send them on a bombing mission on the way out, and then they land in Russia, and then they come home separately. But the problem is, to get there, you have to fly over occupied Norway. And there is a point when the RAF send Halifax bombers to Murmansk, and that's not necessarily to do with Tirpitz, it's to do with protecting the convoys in the Arctic itself. But a number of those aircraft get shot down in the way, and some of them just crash, because flying through the mountains up near the North Cape, where you can't navigate very well, is challenging in the first place. So air attack is not impossible, but it's very difficult. And this brings us to sort of the first solution that the Royal Navy came up with, which is quite novel, which is, if you can't attack it from the air or with surface ships, can you attack it underwater? And sending a conventional submarine into the fjords, again, would be tricky. But slightly by coincidence, various technologies have been developed of miniature submarine, which are potentially ideal for the purpose. This is where the first round of attacks on Tirpitz start, are with these underwater methods.
And when is this? What year is this?
You're talking late 1942.
Right.
So within the first year of Tirpitz being there, and in particular after, because PQ-17 is July, and the convoys are suspended in July 1942, but they're going to start again once it starts getting dark in sort of October time.
Right.
There's no convoys in August and September, but when they're going to start again in October, November, ideally you want to do something about Tirpitz in that window. And the first operation that they come up with is a thing called Operation Title. Prior to this, one of the underwater technologies that existed were things called chariots in British terms. They're called different things by other people. But they were basically first tried out by the Italians. And essentially what this is it's a manned torpedo. They look slightly comical in the sense that it's, if you imagine a torpedo, but with somebody sitting on it as if they're riding a horse,
yep,
with a steering wheel, essentially, with a little sort of control panel and a steering wheel. Basically what they are. So you have somebody in, well, not scuba gear because it wasn't invented, but underwater gear, and they sit on this thing and they drive it to somewhere near the target and they point it at the target and then they swim off and hopefully get picked up or whatever.
Yep.
And the chariot carries on and hits the ship. They've been used successfully by the Italians. There's a strike on Alexandria Harbour in the Mediterranean on the Royal Navy's Mediterranean fleet that is successful. They damage a number of ships. It's not ridiculous technology. It's a perfectly viable thing. But the problem is it's very short range. You can't expect a guy astride a torpedo to cross the North Sea. You have to get them to within a mile or two of the target. And whereas in Alexandria, because the port is on the coast, you can drop your chariots off some distance out to sea and they don't have very far to go. The problem with attacking Tirpitz, who is near Trondheim at the time, is that it's a long way down the fjord inland,
right, okay,
before you get to the ship. And it's further than you want to go on your chariot. So they can't just be dropped off in the open sea. They have to be taken at least part of the way into the fjord. So they come up with a plan where they get a Norwegian fishing trawler. That's a very brave Norwegian fisherman. And the idea is that they will tow the chariots up the fjord, past German checkpoints and everything else. And then when they get far enough in, the divers who've been hiding on the trawler will pop out and get on the chariots and off they go. The trawler would then be scuttled and hopefully everybody would then make their own way to Sweden. Which is a getaway plan isn't the best in the world. But full respect to these people, that's what they were prepared to do. You know, it's one of those operations that, despite the best efforts of everybody concerned and, you know, extraordinary bravery, it fails because the Arthur, the trawler, sails up the fjord. They're stopped by a number of German patrol vessels. And one of the accounts describes one of the crew looking over the stern of this trawler. And the sea is so crystal clear that you can see these two chariots bobbing about below the surface. But fortunately, the Germans don't look over the side and they show all their documents and they carry on going. But then the weather turns, a local storm brews up in the fjord and the stormy water breaks the tow lines. The two torpedoes, the two chariots are lost. And at that point, their stuff, there's nothing they can do. So they just have to then abandon the trawler and the divers and everybody else make a run for it. Fortunately, all but one of them do get to Sweden. But in terms of sinking Tirpitz, it's been a complete failure.
So that's failure number one. Which is next?
Well, failure number two isn't a failure, in fact. What happens in the winter of 1942 into 43 is Tirpitz has actually been operational in the sense of, you know, ready to use for a good year by that point. And she needs a refit, because any major warship, every 12 to 18 months, you just need to service it, like getting your car MOT'd kind of thing. But the Germans don't want to send the ship back to Germany to do this. This was partly why she was in Trondheim in the first place when the Chariots attack was, because that's where they had the servicing facilities and all the things they needed to maintain the ship. But March 43, she completes her refit and she goes back to Altenfjord, which is this position right up near the North Cape, which is really near where the convoys are, which is the best place to attack from, but it doesn't have as many servicing facilities and resources. So she moves back up there, and at that point, Scharnhorst and battlecruiser Lützow are also there. So you've got quite a substantial fleet of powerful warships, which is a major worry. But all these moves are monitored. I mean, as I say, you've got these coast watchers, you've got ultra information. So Bletchley Park and the Royal Navy and the Operation Intelligence Centre know where Tirpitz has gone, and they know what other ships are there. So they know the situation pretty well. A good example of just how sort of timely and accurate this information is that Tirpitz leaves Trondheim to head up to Altenfjord. And that information is in the hands of the Admiralty within 3 hours.
Wow.
Because Torsten Raby, who is a Norwegian coast watcher, is able to see her sailing past him.
Yeah.
And he gets on his wireless set and he's able to send that information back essentially in real time. So the moment Tirpitz moves, the system for detecting that fact kicks into action and it's reported very, very efficiently. Of course, once they know she's potentially at sea, they can start looking at other intelligence. Is she being escorted up the coast? What's going on? Are there preparations being made in Altenfjord for her arrival? All these other snippets. And then you put a reconnaissance Spitfire in the air and go and have a look. See whether another ship has turned up in Altenfjord or whether one's disappeared from Trondheim.
To Murmansk, past Hitler's bomber bases in Norway, over this route, the Nazi Luftwaffe held pitiless and unbreakable sway. From their bases all along the coast, German long-range bombers lay in wait to spot the convoys and keep them under surveillance until short-range dive bombers could strike. At all costs, the Nazis were determined to stop the flow of Lend-Lease aid to Russia. Men of the Navy and the Merchant Marine knew that assignment to the Murmansk run was almost a sentence of eventual death. But for every ship destroyed, for every crew lost, a dozen others got through with their cargoes intact. To Londonderry, to Murmansk, under a hail of bombs and through the wolf packs, the Atlantic convoys got through.
Now, you said there was the next attack. So she moves, and what's this next attack?
Well, the next attack is Operation Source. This one is quite famous. This is the famous use of X-craft, which are miniature submarines, essentially. They're about 50 feet long. They have a crew of, I think, four. They're absolutely miserable things to operate. They're, you know, 50 feet long, but only about 6 feet in diameter. So it's, you're living in this sort of tube. And again, they have to be towed across the North Sea because you can't sail them for long distances. I think when they were towing them, some of the crew had to stay in the submarines while they were being towed to sort of maintain themselves. Rubbish. All these things are very miserable and unpleasant jobs. The way they'll attack the enemy ships is each of them, they have these shaped explosive charges which are sort of strapped to the external hull of the miniature submarine, each of which has 2 tons of explosive in it. So there's a massive bang. It's not a torpedo. It's not something you can fire at the target.
No.
What you have to do is you have to sail your miniature submarine underneath the enemy ship, drop these explosive charges off, and then they sink to the floor of the sea, sit there, and you hopefully sail away in a miniature submarine. And then sometime later on a time fuse, these things will explode. But a ton of explosive going off under the keel of a warship in relatively shallow water will break its back. It's a pretty good method. And the plan isn't just to attack Tirpitz. Scharnhorst and Lützow are not moored nearby. Charnos is actually moored in a different arm of the fjord, so it's a little bit of a distance away. But the idea is that they'll send 6 submarines and they'll part company and go and attack the individual ships.
It's quite adventurous then.
Yeah, it's quite a complicated plan. And of course, the submarines then have to navigate their way back out again and meet their sort of mothership back out at sea, or they're reduced to, like the previous guys, beaching and making for Sweden. The problem with this operation, though, is while I was saying earlier that the Royal Navy kind of wanted Tirpitz to go to sea so they could have a naval battle, for this operation, you need all three ships to be in the fjord. And rather than hoping that the ships would go to sea, they're rather worried that they'll mount the operation and the ships won't be there. So GC and Cess's role is very much one of making sure that the targets are where they're supposed to be. And coincidentally, this is the only time in 1943 that the Tirpitz does anything, because they mount a thing called Operation Citronella, where Tirpitz sails up to the island of Spitsbergen, which has an allied, a very small allied base. And mainly for propaganda reasons, the Germans sail up there, they shell the base, they take a load of people prisoner, they destroy the oil stocks there and things like that. Because Spitsbergen is sort of halfway along the Arctic convoy route, so it's been used as a sort of emergency point and resupply point, refueling point for destroyers and things like that. It's a useful sort of stopping off point on the convoy route. Operation Citronella happens, and Tirpitz goes up there and shells Spitsbergen on the 8th of September. Meanwhile, the Admiralty have been building up for Operation Source on the 20th to the 25th of September. So they're like, oh dear, is Tirpitz going to be back in time?
Right,
you know,
okay.
Because you need to arrange the towing, you know, get everything sorted out. Mounting the operation takes a certain amount of time. You need a bit of build-up. And so they're asking the question, you know, can we launch? Do we know that Tirpitz is going to be back? And actually, on the 9th of September, Enigma messages are intercepted by Bletchley Park that allow them to say, yes, Tirpitz is going to be back by the 20th. Everything's going to be fine. Don't worry. So the X-craft set off. Three for Tirpitz, two for Scharnhorst, and one for Lützow. However, while they're at sea, yet more intelligence comes in. And in this case, it's Enigma saying that Scharnhorst is going to be out doing gunnery trials on the night when the submarines are going to arrive. So she's not in her anchorage. And the problem about this method is you've got to go and drop the explosives underneath the ship. The ship needs to be stationary.
Yeah.
And you need to know it's going to stay where it is for long enough for you to get away. So if Scharnhorst is sailing around, even just within the confines of the fjord, you can't attack it. They were thinking about rejigging the operation, but in the end, it didn't really matter because two of the submarines got sunk on the way across the North Sea before they ever get there. So they're reduced to four, and they decide to basically focus their efforts on Tirpitz with the remaining submarines. It's an extraordinary operation because what you have to remember is these ships are protected by heavy gauge steel nets to prevent them being torpedoed. So you've got basically a sort of underwater cage of netting running around the ship. And the only way the X-craft can get underneath the ship is they have to find their way through these nets. One thing you can do is if you sort of lurk about, there's a kind of gate in the net, and the
right.
Germans do open and close the net for smaller traffic going in and out. So you can try and follow another ship when it goes in. Or because they're designed to stop torpedoes, they don't go all the way to the bottom of to the seabed. They go as deep as a torpedo would travel, basically. So you can kind of go deep and try and go underneath, or you can just sort of find where two nets join and kind of push through the gap. So they are penetrable, but it's extremely difficult. And the detailed accounts of this operation are full of nervous moments as these guys are trying to, A, work out where they are, because navigating underwater is extremely difficult. So they have to kind of pop up and pop their little periscope up to see where they are, and they risk getting spotted. If they get entangled in a net, they're in real trouble because, you know, it could damage the submarine or whatever. In consequence of that, all but one of the X-craft sink. They're lost. But two of them do manage to get close enough to Tirpitz to lay charges underneath. Unfortunately, one of the submarines is spotted by the Germans before the charges have gone off. And the captain of Tirpitz kind of figures out what's going on. He thinks they might have laid mines under his ship. So he has the Tirpitz swung on its anchor, so it sort of pivots around from where it was originally positioned to a slightly different position. And then these charges go off with massive explosions. But because they're not right underneath the ship, although Tirpitz is substantially damaged, it's not sunk. What's particularly disconcerting for one of the X-craft crews is they're forced to surrender and they're captured and they're actually taken onto Tirpitz. So they're standing on Tirpitz knowing that there are tons of explosives under the ship
and that
the clocks are ticking. So they're literally on board with German officers going, what have you done? What can we expect? Why are you here? And these guys are going, we don't know, we've done nothing, you know, name, rank and number kind of thing. And then all of a sudden there's these massive explosions. They survive, but they weren't expecting to still be there when the charges went
off.
The problem from the Allied point of view, of course, at this point is because the X-craft, only one of them manages to get back, and that's one that had not got all the way in anyway. So it's like, have we succeeded? Has the ship been sunk? Has it not been sunk? You know, what's going on? And you can send a reconnaissance aircraft the following day and go, yeah, Tirpitz is still sitting there. So it clearly hasn't sunk, but has it been damaged? How badly has it been damaged? And this is where Bletchley Park and Enigma come in again, because there's a sort of a burst of communication as they try and work out what damage has been done, how they got attacked. All the sort of court of inquiry starts by wireless, more or less straight away. And there's a particularly interesting message from 22nd of September, which is the morning after the battle. It gives a description of 500 cubic metres of water being taken on by the ship. So they've blown a hole in the ship.
TOI at 12:16 on the 22nd of September 1943. From Battle Group via Steinbrink to Operations Division, Gruppe Nordflotte. Most immediate. Heavy explosion 60 metres to port of Tirpitz at 10:12. Submarine destroyed by time bombs. 500 cubic metres of water in the ship. A second submarine was destroyed by time bombs 300 metres on the ship's starboard bow at 10:35. Commanding officer was taken prisoner. A third submarine was fired on when 600 metres distant on the starboard beam, several hits being observed.
Further messages were also received, one of which required a specialist welding ship to be sent up to the fjord. So there's clearly massive repairs that need to be made. And so it's clear that Tirpitz isn't going to be doing anything in the short term. But then the question is, how long will it take the Germans to fix it?
Right.
When can we expect it to be back in service? This becomes even more significant after December 43, because at that point, Scharnhorst has been sunk at Battle of the North Cape. And so Tirpitz is basically the only surviving German battleship up there. So if Tirpitz is out of commission, even if still floating, that's it for German battleships. You can kind of rule out getting attacked again. So your convoys, there's a whole level of protection you don't have to provide for your convoys. Or you can certainly be more confident with your convoys. There's still German destroyers and things like that. But the absence of any significant capital ships would be a huge bonus. So they're monitoring the intelligence very closely to try and figure out how badly the ship is damaged, how long it'll take to repair it, and things like that. They notice, for example, things like crew being sent on leave back to Germany. And at one point, a 100-ton floating crane is requested. And that's because when you look at these World War II battleships, the 15-inch guns are in these massive rotating turrets, you know, with the three guns poking out the front. What people don't appreciate about these things is those turrets sit on a ball-bearing race, circular race, so they can rotate. But they're not fixed on. They're so heavy that the only thing that keeps them in position is gravity. The explosion is so powerful that it's blown the turrets sort of a foot in the air, and then they've fallen back down again, and they're not properly seated on their ball bearings anymore. So although the turret is intact, it's just jumped out of its spot. And so you've got to get a crane and winch up and put it back in the right place again. This is why when you look at things like the wreck of the Bismarck, it's like a side issue, but if you look at wrecks of battleships, if they turn turtle as they sink, the turrets fall off. And so when you look at the wreckage on the bottom of the sea, the turrets will be separate from the ship because they've detached themselves. But yeah, so it's pretty clear. They're getting a 100-ton crane. The crew are all being sent on leave. And so between Naval Section and the Operational Intelligence Centre, they're able to determine that it's going to be at least mid-March 44 before Tirpitz is seaworthy again. And they produce a report in January of 44 saying that the Admiralty's got at least two clear months, if you like, for convoy operations.
So at this point, we're going to stop and we'll carry on this story in part two.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.